When you challenge somebody and they step into a leadership role, or they choose to step into it of their own accord, you know, that's just the most exciting thing ever, watching somebody come into their own out of their own volition. It's exciting, but I think it's an evolution from civilians just being doers to that we're all leaders in our organization, no matter where we sit.
Hello, and welcome back to Leader Up, a podcast of Army Management Staff College. Leader Up is a professional conversation where we discuss a broad range of leadership and leader development topics with an emphasis on the Army civilian professional. I'm your host, David Howie. And on today's episode of Leader Up audience, we have a great guest, someone that I'm really interested in talking to. This is Mr. Paul Landauer, and he is the J8 for AFRICOM, and he is a member of the Senior Executive Service. And so, Mr. Paul Landauer, I want to bring you in now and just thank you for giving us a little bit of your time to talk about leadership and some other fun topics today on Leader Up. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's start off a little bit about you, your background, and kind of how you got to where you are now as the J8 of AFRICOM.
Absolutely. I'll try and keep it as succinct as possible. I've been working for the Department of Defense for about 22 years. I actually started as a financial management trainee in the Department of the Navy in 2002. It was like a two-year program with a bunch of rotations, and that moved me around. And during that time, I got exposure to all sorts of portions of the Navy, but also got to go and work at the White House in their budget office for a period of time, various SISCOMs, OPNAV, which is, you know, Navy requirements side. So really good, varied experience. And then I got hired to work in the Navy Secretariat for Comptroller and Financial Management. And I spent the preponderance of my career there, and we'll talk more about the goods and the bads of that choice. But everything from air ops to ship ops to Marine Corps ops to investment, SCN lead, aviation. So I kind of did all the O&M all the way to the acquisition side. And then I took a brief stint and did, I was the business financial manager for Ohio A replacement, which is now called Columbia, which is the ballistic missile replacement submarine, and got to live life sort of down echelon inside of an acquisition program office. A very challenging job. Did that for a few years and then got pulled back into the Navy comptroller at the secretariat level and focused on revolving funds and civilian personnel and IT budgeting. I was picked up for executive to lead the Navy Working Capital Fund Industrial Ops and civilian personnel division, and that included IT budgeting. After a few years there, I got exposed to some data analytics, and I thought that that was the future. And so I stood up a branch to do some data analytic efforts. And after about a year of doing that and not making a ton of progress, I went to my leadership and I said, hey, data analytics is the future. Somebody should really do this as a full-time job, because I was trying to manage my existing workload and this really sort of transformational work. They said, that's great, you're hired. And I was asked to then lead a team to stand up the Navy's data and digital transformation for financial management. And I did that for the last 3 years or so. And then at that point, doing data and digital transformation kind of opened my eyes to the, wow, I've been doing Navy for 22 years. There's a lot I don't know. It would be good to go out and get some experience with another service. And COCOM came out as one of those opportunities. And so I applied and was hired to be the J8 here at U.S. Africa Command. And we'll talk a little bit more, I think, here about some of the responsibilities of being the J8. So that was my journey really quickly to becoming the J8 here at AFRICOM.
And I do want to hear a little bit more about your specific job, the kind of things that you focus on.
Yep.
But tell our audience a little bit before we get into that about AFRICOM.
Sure.
What AFRICOM is, yep, and what are kind of some of the challenges that it faces now?
Sure. So AFRICOM is a geographic combatant command. We're responsible for the area of operations for the continent of Africa, There are 54 countries in Africa, 53 of which fall into the AOR. Egypt actually does not fall into AFRICOM's AOR. So 53 countries. Just to give you a sense of the size of Africa, we have one country, Somalia, specifically. The coast of Somalia alone is equidistant to the coast of the eastern seaboard of the United States. And so if you think about the tyranny of distance associated with AFRICOM, a very varied continent, also one of the fastest growing, and we think by 2050, roughly one in four people in the world will live on the African continent. So it is a young continent. The average age is something like, we expect by 2050 to be in sort of the 19 to 21 years old. As we say here, right, Africa, the country, is literally the future of the world, a very complex theater and located adjacent to three other COCOMs, meaning EUCOM, SOUTHCOM, and CENTCOM. And so we have to work coordination across them. And AFRICOM was set up to be a security cooperation command. However, and we don't have assigned forces, but we do have many of the challenges associated with being a geographic command, associated with the risk and having forces on continent, protecting them, and then protecting American interests on the continent as well. So very dynamic and challenging environment.
And Leader Up audience, I'll just tell you, if you don't understand geographic commands and all of that, I would encourage you to do some independent research and kind of find that out, because it is a part of our environment, and it is the way that the United States fights its wars now through those geographic commands, and AFRICOM is one of them. And I would encourage you, if you don't understand that system, to jump in and learn a little bit about it, because there are jobs in these overseas in these commands that are available to us as Army civilians or other branch civilians. And so tell us a little bit about the J-8. What does it mean to be the J-8, and what kind of challenges do you face, and how do you deal with those?
Thank you for the question. And so the J-8, there are many hats here that I'll talk about. And so there's things that you would probably normally associate with a J-8 are comptroller functions. And that's everything from allocation of resources, unfunded requirements, doing requirements through the Army resource process. Army is our combatant command service, and so they provide the resources for the headquarters. I have a comptroller team that does, you know, everything from the program to the budget to the execution to the audit and financial reporting associated with AFRICOM is one portion of the team. The other portion of our team is the requirements. And so everything from the integrated priorities listed, which it usually covers down on what we see as capability gaps in the theater. And so the commander has a list of gaps. Those are called IPLs. So we are responsible for keeping track of that. We also do, every combatant command is tasked by Congress to provide an unfunded priority list every year, and that's one of our products. And then we work through what's called the program budget review cycle with CAPE and comptroller annually through that process. So we're in PBR 26 for right now, for example. The other portion of our team is the assessments team. And so there's a group of operations research folks that work for me, and we do the annual joint assessment, which is feeds to the chairman's risk assessment. So AFRICOM feeds a portion of that. And we provide that service to the joint staff, as well as that team produces our annual campaign assessment. So AFRICOM has a campaign plan and a campaign order. And my team, with coordination with the rest of the AFRICOM team, assesses that effectiveness over time. And then the final portion of our team here in the J-8 is the S&T team. We have a small group of folks where we're trying to facilitate and advocate for science, technology, innovation, and experimentation in the AOR. And we provide various services to try and advocate for those types of operational assessments. One of the things we're working on is trying to get a long endurance intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platform into the theater. So a really big glider can dwell for a really long time, obviously would be beneficial in an AOR that's as big as ours. And so those are the three major thrusts. I have one other responsibility that I would think is worth mentioning. I'm the senior civilian for AFRICOM. And so my job includes the care and feeding of the civilian personnel here. I'm not the J1. And so that there's a little bit of delineation there, but mentoring, coaching, professional development, thinking about how we recruit and retain and working in partnership with the J1 and the rest of the staff. Civilians make up about between 50 and 60% of the staff here at AFRICOM. And so it's important because we're OCONUSly located here in Stuttgart, Germany, that presents some unique challenges. And it also presents a lot of opportunities associated with that. And so that's another part of my responsibilities here in AFRICOM as the J8, but is a unique to my specific role. Any follow-ons to that, David, that you wanted to ask? I don't know if I hit everything you wanted me to hit there.
Well, you did, but you brought up another question for me, and that is, you mentioned that you're the J8 as a member of the SES, as an SES.
Yep.
What are the other staff principals? Are they military, civilian, SESs? Sure. Not necessarily all of them, but just how many other of your peers are SESs?
Yeah, it's a great question. So on the AFRICOM Army staff, if you will, I am the only SES here in the command. There are other organizations that support AFRICOM that bring SES level folks, like three-letter agencies that support us. There are some others. There's also, we have an ambassador for AFRICOM, Ambassador Rob Scott. Obviously, that's actually well above the executive ranks, if you will. He's on the staff, but as in most of my counterparts are at the three and two star level. The DCOM is three star, and then chief of staff and some of the other G8ers are two and one stars. And so it's generally the rest of AFRICOM for the most part at the direct, my counterpart level are military members from across the services, since we are a joint command.
And what you're saying is, because you are a member of the SES, you kind of have taken on another function, and that is to kind of be the wise mentor to the civilians in the AFRICOM staff. Is that correct? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, that's correct. It's one of the things they actually hired me for and brought me over as one of my passions is in becoming an executive. Truly, the work is the work, and I believe in the mission and what we're working on. But one of the things that really passionate about and that I really enjoy is developing people. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to become an executive. You know, coming to a command and being able to bring that passion to bear in a meaningful way and really support the staff here. And then it's a lot of fun and there's a ton of opportunity and it runs the gamut, right? It's everything from, you know, do folks have access to mentoring and coaching? And are we thinking about how we do professional development here for our, you know, largely civilian population? Are we thinking about our grade structures and how we hire and who we hire? And are we, are we advocating for the benefits of the command and the experience that you're going to get by coming here? And then caring and feeding all the way through departure, right? Is that how do we offboard folks in a meaningful way so that they have a positive experience as they leave? And so it isn't, it's everything from before you get here to when you're here to after you've left. And so there's a lot to that body of work. You know, one of the first things as I talked to the commander about when I first met with him when I got here was, you know, can we see the civilian workforce? What are the data and analytics around that? And a little bit of that because I have a data, you know, background, but, you know, how many, you know, at what GS levels and how long have people been here? And if they choose to leave early, why is that? And how many people are prior military? And so it, when you start to understand your workforce, you can then begin to build the in-support structure that helps them to improve and progress along their careers. Because we're all progressing. Some people have different aspirations than others, and that's perfectly okay. But how do we do that in a meaningful way in a largely military organization? Are we doing the care and feeding for our civilians? And I'll say it's just in my experience throughout my career, there were just moments in my career where if I just had a little bit of advice, it would have helped a lot. And it doesn't take much. Little things have big impacts on most people's lives, has been my experience, especially in the professional development range.
And so the civilians that you're talking about, are they DOD civilians, Army, Navy, or are they all of the above?
The vast preponderance of the folks that we have here on staff at AFRICOM are Army civilians, but we also do have Defense Intelligence Agency civilians. We have National Geospatial civilians. We have USAID civilians. And so it runs the gamut from Department of State to across DOD and across the DOD agencies, DITRA, for example. And so, and I've taken on the role not just to be, you know, here for Army civilians, but for the civilian teammates. And so it really does run the gamut.
And you kind of bring me to my next point that I want to talk about, and it is the changing or evolving role of civilians in the workplace. And normally on our podcast, we talk Army civilians, and most of your folks are Army civilians, but I know all the other branches are trying to develop leader development programs and all of that. But your civilians that you see, how have you seen the role of those folks change since the time that you've been associated with the military?
Yeah. And there are some things, and I'll bring to light some things that have changed and some things that haven't, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And so one of the big things, and some of this is a little bit from a financial management bent, you know, is, you know, civilians are the continuity, and that really hasn't changed. What I think has changed is that more and more, and I see this a lot in the financial management realm, which is, you know, why I'm bringing it out a little bit, is, you know, in the past, financial management and the civilians associated were largely viewed as a back office function, right? We were, you know, providing some information. It was usually in the rearview mirror. And what I've seen evolve over time, and I think it's true, not just in the financial realms, but more broadly, is that the civilian teammates are taking on a more prominent role because of the way information is flowing and because of that continuity, and truly because of the time it takes to drive what is major change or major transformation, is that I've seen civilians take a more prominent role at, you know, at the boardroom table, right? At those key leader decision points. And that's a combination of, you know, data is moving at the speed of operations or speed of relevance. And therefore having folks that have enough depth and breadth to really bring in that level of information is important because there's that continuity aspect, but also is that major change. And I think all of DOD certainly is, you know, we're in a constant state of change for sure, but the DOD landscape is shifting around us in pretty rapid succession. And our civilian teammates present a unique position to bring different insights, some built on continuity and some built on varied experience that allows us to offer a perspective that we might not otherwise get. And so it's really a, you know, things are the same, but things are dramatically different, if you will. And I've seen where the civilian teammates are in a much more prominent role than they've been in the past and being asked to provide, you know, a much more significant, you know, advice and insight. And that isn't to downplay what our military members are providing. Our warfighters are critical and their experience and their role. But as the DOD evolves, I think the civilian contribution continues to be significant and grow over time. To complement our warfighters, if you will.
And in our leadership manual, ADP 622, when we published the most recent version of it a couple of years back, the Civilian Corps creed was updated to say, instead of just saying we provide or I provide stability and continuity, that creed was updated to say I provide leadership, stability, and continuity. I think that's what you're kind of getting at is we look at civilians and we say, you need to roll your sleeves up, get involved. Get involved early so that you can affect things before they happen, not being brought in, like you're saying, after the fact, or to stand on the sidelines and just be the Monday morning quarterback, which is kind of the way civilians were looked at, I'll say 30 or so years ago. And I think you're right that we expect more from civilians, and civilians are being expect more is expected of them, and we are giving them the tools to perform those functions in the organizations.
Yeah, one of the things that I got illumined to and highlighted was the, you know, as you do coaching and mentoring, a lot of folks will be like, well, I need to be in this role to be a leader. I need to be the branch head. I need to be the div chief. What I always encourage people is to choose to lead wherever you are. And there's great books out there, 360 degree leadership. There's a couple others. But don't wait to be in a role to provide leadership. Be a leader wherever, whatever role you're in. Don't be afraid to take on that leadership role. That's where you cut your teeth. That's where you show and you develop what kind of leader you're going to be. You develop it as you go through your career. It's not like you land in some job and suddenly you're a leader. You know, you're honing your craft your whole career. And so if you see it that way, then you're constantly looking for opportunities to provide leadership and share leadership and grow others and mentor. I think that's been a shift, if you will, as opposed to just being a bunch of doers, is that we're all a bunch of leaders. Are we willing to step into that role in a meaningful way? Because I don't know a supervisor out there, and I don't know a leader out there who doesn't love to see that happen, right? When you challenge somebody and they step into a leadership role, or they choose to step into it of their own accord, you know, that's just the most exciting thing ever, watching somebody come into their own out of their own volition. It's exciting, but I think it's an evolution from civilians just being doers to that we're all leaders in our organization, no matter where we sit.
And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some leadership topics. And these are things that I taught in the intermediate course for many years. And these are some of the things that kind of kept coming up over and over again. And the first one that I'd like to talk about is delegation. Why does that matter? What are your own personal views about delegation?
I think delegation is one of the most important ones, but as a leader, probably one of the hardest. Making that shift, and it's true, you'll think about it more on each individual's career, especially if you're an expert in a field, right? And we value experts in the DoD, and usually you're going to get promoted through your MOS or the area that you're good at, and that's kind of typical career progression. I'll tell you the challenges as you grow in your career, what got you here won't get you there, another great book, is the reality is that you have to hone your ability to learn to delegate. And so a couple of things about delegation is it requires you to trust and empower your team. And as a technical expert, it's not going to be done the way that you would do it. Right. And you're going to delegate it to somebody who's not you. And so therefore it can't be done how you would do it because they're not you. It's impossible. So how do you delegate? How do you empower and trust your team to execute? And I'll tell you, if you can't learn how to delegate, then you likely aren't trusting and empowering, and you will, as a leader, experience catastrophic failure because you will become a bottleneck, right? And you will be unable to execute a wider range as you grow in your career. And so it will be a limb fact, right? And so you have to practice delegation and you have to try it. And actually, frankly, right, delegation is one of those things where when you empower and trust, you're also taking a risk. And actually, the most powerful times of delegation is when somebody fails under your delegated authority. You provide that overarching, that was my responsibility and my fault. I take ownership of that. And the employee sees you take that on with a, hey, did you learn anything? And what did we learn? And did we grow from that? Okay, go do it again. That's the most powerful in delegation. If you're going to delegate only to hold accountable and pass down, right, negative or constructive all the time that isn't productive, then your team isn't going to learn that you have their best interest in mind. And so that's a particular, you know, in delegation requires a leader to trust and empower, but also to accept the risk associated with that, even when stakes are very, very high. And so Extreme Ownership, another book, talks about the as a leader, that's yours to own, but that's not yours to take on, right? Is that you have to accept that risk. And then go back and look as a leader, where did I miss the chance to help my team and empower them to make sure that they did the best they could? So did I give them the tools and the resources associated with it? And those are my kind of short thoughts on delegation. Truly, right? If you can't learn to delegate as a leader, my coach, and I would tell you, anybody who's, if you ever have the chance to get executive coaching, I highly recommend it. My executive coach would ask me regularly, are you going to be a doer or are you going to be a leader? And he would ask me to look at my schedule and say, what are the things that I'm doing that I absolutely shouldn't be? And why haven't I delegated them yet? And what am I afraid of? And it takes real work and real accountability to continue to grow in that. And I also think, especially in the areas where I am an expert or would consider myself to be an expert, those are the ones I really have to watch. And I ask my team actually to hold me accountable to that, is to say, if I am doing things I'm not supposed to, I want you team to call me out on that and correct me and say, those aren't things you should be doing. And please delegate that down. And so I know where I struggle a little bit. And so I put those sort of checks in place with my team to provide some level of accountability, because I know that I will naturally gravitate away from that in specific areas.
And what I think you're saying is that a leader has to know their tendencies,
yep,
and what they are likely to do.
Yeah.
And then tell the people around them, like you're saying, I give you permission to give me corrective feedback if you see me doing these things. Because I know if I get too worked up, I am likely to start micromanaging.
Yep.
When that happens, I need you to tell me that. I need you to tell me, I got it. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it.
David, two things I would say out of that is good leaders are very self-aware, right? And so if you're not soliciting and giving and getting feedback from a variety of sources, and then you're also not learning to be self-aware and studying yourself. So Myers-Briggs, 360 degree, there are lots of ways to become self-aware and lots of leadership classes that will help you with that. Good leaders are very self-aware. And when you're self-aware, you can free your team to help you be more effective. But if you're not self-aware, then your team is caught in a rock and a hard place of the leader is so unaware, they don't know where they're self-destructive. And we see it a lot. And I coach people sometimes that aren't self-aware. And sometimes the only thing I can do is help them become more self-aware. But until they do, they won't see past that block or that thing that's standing in their own way. And that's frankly, a lot of times, most folks, the block is themselves. And it's them realizing that and then figuring out how to work through it is often what we all struggle with in some way or another.
And let's talk a little bit more about feedback. That's kind of another fun leadership thing to talk about.
Yep.
The value, the importance of feedback, both giving it to others and listening to others' feedback. So I want to get feedback. I want to give feedback to the people that I'm working around. I want them to know how I see things, but I also want to solicit their feedback and be open to their feedback. What are some things that you've learned about feedback over the years?
So I'll give you my one trick of the trade that's tried and true. As you progress in your career, it gets harder and harder to get feedback. So you have to solicit it. And it's great to learn how to receive feedback early in your career. You should be open to it. And if you're closed to it, then people will stop giving it to you even faster, right? And so one is, am I open to feedback, right? As an individual, you got to ask yourself that. Like, am I open to it? Then two, go ask somebody for it, right? Ask your boss tomorrow, hey, do you have any feedback for me? Or would you mind meeting with me to give me some feedback? Can I get on your schedule? So those are easy ones. One trick of the trade that's tried and true is people, if you say, hey, do you have any feedback for me broadly like that? As you get more senior, people are like, no, everything you do is perfect. You're great. You're wonderful. And which I hate, right? Because I'm not learning and I'm not improving. I'm not actually interested when I do well on some level. I really want to know where I need to improve and where I'm not quite getting it right. And that's a lifelong journey. That's not a career thing. That's a forever thing. And so if you tweak it just a little bit, and if you say, hey, do you have one thing that I could do better? Or what's one area that I need to improve? People can come up with one thing and they don't feel like they have to do the laundry list, right? And so sometimes it's easy to seed that too of the, hey, I want to come see you and I'm going to ask you, hey, what's one thing I can improve? And then they have time to think about it. Sometimes putting people on the spot makes them a little bit uncomfortable with feedback. So you give them time, or you schedule and say, hey, I'm going to solicit feedback from you is really important. I find as well that if you ask immediately after an engagement, how do you think that went? What did I do well? Where do you think I need to improve? Are there, you know, is there anything that I need to clean up or anything? And so almost out of every meeting I go to, I'll walk out and I'll walk into at least one other person's office and I say, hey, what'd you think of that? How'd we do? What, you know, any feedback? I regularly solicit feedback. I also regularly take the time to give it to my teammates and not just my direct subordinates. If I see somebody and I also think giving positive feedback is all more valuable often than constructive feedback. Constructive feedback, you gotta think through that. You should, depending on the situation, you should practice constructive feedback. Don't just launch into it, right? A really hard conversation. If you haven't practiced a really hard conversation with another person, then you're probably not ready to have a real hard conversation, or you're going to have it and it's not going to go well because you haven't thought through your words. But we're just people, and people struggle sometimes. And so sometimes also what I find is super effective, especially for hard conversations, is asking folks their thoughts first. So if you have a particular incident in mind or a particular issue, hey, what did you think about that? And ask them to self-reflect. Super effective. And 9 times out of 10, people will self-actualize. And all you have to do is, hey, I agree with you. What are some things that you and I can do together to work through to make that better? And now you're in a partnership mode. And so people are getting constructive feedback of their own doing, and you're in a partnership mode to help them improve. So those are just some tricks of the trade. It's not a book, it's a talk. I think you can search it on YouTube, called Radical Candor, a fairly good video. It's fairly short, worth your time if you're out there surfing the YouTube webs looking for something to talk about feedback.
And sometimes I wonder if people look at an SES or a general officer or whatever rank, there's a rank that people see that they think, well, that person they've hit nirvana. If they're at that level, they know everything about themselves. Yeah. They're completely self-aware. They've heard it all before. They don't need to get feedback from lowly little me. down here in my cubicle. And that is not the case.
Correct. Yeah, I would tell you, I am never the smartest person in a room. And if I'm the smartest person in a room, my first action is to run out of that room, right? And said a little bit different way, is the SESs and GOFOs, you know, we're all just people too. Put our pants on one leg at a time. Frankly, feedback and the growth and the personal growth, again, continues your whole life. You don't get to a point in your career where you shouldn't be continuing to grow or continuing to solicit people to help you grow. And honestly, I would argue the minute you stop thinking that you need to grow, it's time to get out, right? Or it's, you know, there's something wrong. You should never be satisfied that you've reached the pinnacle. It should always be, it is a journey, not a destination, if you will.
And what you said, I think, is very important for those of us that are kind of out here still on the business end of getting tasks done.
Yeah.
Is that our leaders, the higher up a leader gets, the harder it is for that person to get the candid feedback. And so for us to remember that the higher up someone is in the chain of command, they struggle. Some of them struggle to get genuine feedback.
Yeah.
Because they have folks around them well-intentioned, absolutely well-intentioned, that I want to support my boss. So I'm not going to tell him all these things. But at some point, they become isolated and they stop hearing the feedback, or they stop getting it. And then we have all these misunderstandings.
Yep.
They're doing things that are not helpful, but nobody's willing to tell them about it.
And some of that is on the leader, right? It is our responsibility to set the conditions that make people feel like they can have avenues to provide that. That's a two-way street. It's important that there's responsibility there. It's easy to get isolated in a leadership position really quickly, right? You sit in your office and it can go really dark really fast and not have a lot of comms if you're not out there trying to make sure you got a good sense of the organization. I think that's just incredibly important. You're absolutely correct, David, is the leaders don't grow without, staffs helping them. And truly what I see a lot in the mentoring coaching role is that often we all have our greatest strengths or our greatest weaknesses, if you will. And so we all have, and we are all always going to have things that are, our Achilles, and we need help. As a collective, if there are things that I do that are self-destructive to me, I'm self-aware of some of them, but not all of them, and I never will be. And I'll give you an example. I was speaking on a panel at a really big conference. So there's about 1,000 folks in the audience, and I had different genders on the panel. And after I was done, which I, did a lot of, high-fiving and backslapping, and thought it was a great panel, I was moderating it. And an individual on my team pulled me aside and said, hey, for one particular gender, you had one response. And for the other genders, you did not. That was noticed. I was completely unaware of it. But I then learned something about myself that I needed to become more self-aware. And if that person hadn't pulled me aside and given me that feedback, I would have continued on with that. A small thing, it took them less than, 5 seconds to give me that feedback. I'd gone 22 years and never received any feedback like that. And so it, gave me a lot of pause, but really powerful to provide that. So just a small example.
And what that person did was helpful for you. What made that feedback effective was they narrowed in on your behaviors. They told you this is what you did or what you did say or didn't say. And sometimes we leap over all that and we just describe somebody, say, you have a problem with such and such. Okay, well, I don't think I do. So what? And then when I get my behaviors, then I can kind of go back and look at, did I really do that? And I can ask somebody else, and they'll say, yes, come to think of it, you did do that.
Yeah, the number one rule of feedback, right? If you ask for it or if somebody gives it to you, whether it was asked for or not, is you say, thank you for the feedback. You don't have to say anything more. And it's already been a good engagement. But don't resist the urge to be defensive. Say thank you and think about it first. Super important, because if you shut feedback off, people will learn to stop giving you feedback. And I see it a lot where people have just shut that part off. And so people stop trying to help them improve.
So I want to start to wrap this conversation up, but I want to talk about the career advice that you might give to someone, or what you would say to someone who says, I want to be an SES, or I want to progress in the Army or in the civilian world. I want to do as much as I possibly can. What kind of advice would you give that person that they should focus on in their career now?
So I said it already a little bit, right? Be a leader in every role you're in. Don't wait for that, whatever position it is. Start thinking about what is your leadership philosophy today and start putting it into practice. Try it. I would tell you that you need mentors, and that's with an S. I tell people 3 is a good number, and you should, you can have it in your direct line of supervision. I don't encourage that. It can be done. But you have to recognize that person's, got a conflict, if you will, and that's not always bad, but I tell people mentors and 3, and I encourage people to have one, at least one that's not in DOD, right? An industry person or somebody who's just going to think really differently. It'll give you a perspective that you wouldn't get potentially inside of DOD. 2, inside, 1 outside generally. And you should initiate having those mentor relationships in place. Mentors often will challenge you. They'll help you self-aware. They'll also help you navigate job and those moments of change. And it's helpful to have that relationship in place before you experience those moments of change. And frankly, that's another part that I would advise. If you aspire to something, then you need to meet with someone and talk about that aspiration, and you need to put it on paper. And so what I ask anybody who mentors with me knows, right? I ask folks to fill out a piece of paper, and I say, what's your near-term, mid-term, and long-term plan? You don't have to pick your path, but I want you to pick what could be your paths. Put it on paper. And then on that same piece of paper, I want you to tell me what you think your strengths are, and what, more importantly, what you think your weaknesses are. We're pretty self-aware of strengths. We're not very self-aware of weaknesses. And if you don't know your weaknesses, you're probably not working on them. And so I advise people, if you're not working on your weaknesses, you're not really growing, as an example. The last part of that piece of paper is usually like a resume that is, but in essence, the job itself. So it shows up as like 12 lines or 5 lines, depending on how many jobs you've had. And so that when you meet with a mentor, you can kind of talk through that. And then what I always do with my mentors, I take that piece of paper with me. And on the bottom of that sheet, I write down the questions I want to ask that mentor. And so that's a little bit about how I would mentor you, but about how I would encourage you and what advice I would give you. If you're sort of pursuing the SES, I think you have to decide your why. Why do I want to be an SES? What about it? Because if you're not clear on that, the machine will kind of eat you up and spit you out a little bit. If you're not clear on why you want to do something, it's worth putting down on a piece of paper. The other advice that I would give, to look at that experience. I'll tell you that it was really, really fast. And I got a mile wide and an inch deep really, really fast. And I wish earlier on in my career, I'd gotten more varied experiences and broadened myself a little bit. And so that's one of the other piece of my mentoring sheet is that, what are the career broadening experiences you could pursue? Some people see that as a sidestep or as a, well, I'm going to miss this progression line. If you're good at what you do and you display strong leadership aptitude, you'll be just fine. But I wish I know for me that I varied it up just a little bit. And so those are kind of my main pieces of advice that I throw out to those aspiring into the senior executive service.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about the senior executive service, because I don't know that people understand what that means, because sometimes I hear people say, well, they're the equivalent of civilian general officers. Well, kind of, but not really. But I want to ask you this question this way. It's about the symbol of the SES Corps, that keystone.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you that is the symbol of the senior executive service?
I'll give you the textbook ChatGPT answer, and then I'll give you my read on it. And so, you know, if you ask GPT to tell you what the keystone is, it is the center stone in an arch that holds all the other stones in place. So that's what a keystone is. And that's what if you see an SES symbol, that the keystone is that. And I would tell you from my seat, how do I see the keystone? I would flip it a little bit. I view it more like I'm a brick on the pavement. And my job as the SES truly, right, is to remove barriers, to advocate for my team and the teams that they engage with, and frankly, to get out of the way. If you're a good leader, people aren't tripping over you. I'm a nice, smooth rock on the ground, key to the path, and I help people get where they're going, and I'm encouraging them to get there, but I'm not a barrier. And I'm an advocate. And truly, if my help's not needed, then I want people to just execute, right? I want to empower the team. That's a little bit of a flip on the keystone. It's on the ground, not on the arch. And I would say, you know, I'm not the person that holds the team together. The team is what holds it together. I tell my team all the time, I've never had a good idea in my life, but I know one when I see one, and I'm happy to advocate for it. That's a little spin on the keystone.
And in our final moments, I want to talk to you a little bit about just some books, leadership books, or any book that you think would be useful for someone who's in the civilian world, Army civilian or DOD civilian or whatever they might be.
Yeah, David, there are no shortage of books. And what I would tell you, if you're reading, then you're doing better than most, right? So are you an active learner, and are you trying, are you thinking about how to improve or even engaging your brain on an idea or concept that it hasn't thought about? Just reading alone is valuable and important. What you read, you can vary. Some books that I've found helpful in my career, the old classic Winning Friends and Influencing Others, great read. It's an oldie but a goodie. Factfulness, for those entering sort of the data world, that was the book I read that really sort of started the fire that was going on my data journey and my extreme ownership. I think I mentioned it already. This fact that you own it, whether it was a success or a failure, and not in the ownership of I need to go accountability, but that I have a role to play, that if the team missed, I missed. Culture Code is another great one. It really talks about how teams' effectiveness can largely be measured on their interactions. What kind of interactions do you have with your team? And do you set the conditions that are going to be high performing, or do you set the conditions that are going to generate a low performing team? And those, it's a fascinating read about some of the data of teams. Art of the Possibility, I'm an eternal optimist, so that's a fantastic book. And so there's just a few, those are all recommendations.
And we've included those in the show notes for this episode. And so, Mr. Paul Landauer, I really, really want to thank you for your time today, talking to our Leader Up audience about leadership and a little bit about AFRICOM. Thank you so much for giving us your time today on Leader Up.
Thank you, David, and thank you to the listeners. I truly, it is an honor and a privilege to work for the Department of the Army and support AFRICOM and our warfighters. I wake up every morning excited about the day and the opportunity to serve. And I really appreciate the podcast and Leader Up and you guys taking the time to let me chat with you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And so, Leader Up audience out there, what did you hear today from Paul Landauer that kind of sparks your interest? Delegation, feedback. Are you afraid to delegate? Are you uncomfortable with delegating? Are you uncomfortable or afraid of giving feedback? It's understandable that you feel that way, but at some point you have to make a decision to do the right thing. Subscribe to our YouTube page and keep in touch, and join us again next time for another edition of Leader Up.
As always, if you have any questions or feedback or would like to learn more about our podcast, please check the description for our email and for our website. Thanks for listening.